This is the Elevate.
So we're here at the end of the Trial Lawyers University Conference and been recording all week. Robert's been out here from Law Pods producing all of our shows, flew out here with the equipment. We thank you so much for doing that. It's been great recording live and I just really appreciate it.
No, fellas, I can't tell you what an absolute pleasure it's been to come here and do this for you. We've been working together for a while on your show. We've had some conversations over Zoom, but this is the first time to see you both in person, and it was every bit as good as I hoped it would be. So thanks so much for letting me be involved in your podcast, and this kind of lets me live my dream too. So thanks.
No, you were fantastic, and you know what? Everything is fully professional. You've been amazing to work with, and you do such a great job. So in addition to being a good person, so thank you.
Thanks so much.
And a recovering lawyer.
Yeah, I did my time.
Thanks. Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon.
We're here live at the PSBR Trial College.
How
are you doing?
We're still here. Day two or three. What day is it now?
I think it's technically day three, but it feels like day two.
Right.
I think you have it the other way around. I think it's technically day two and it feels like day three.
Oh, that is sounding like somebody who's exhausted.
Yeah. That sounds correct to me. I'm going with that. Yep.
Now with that introductory negative energy, Ibieri, how are you?
I'm doing well. Trust me, it has nothing to do with PSBR. It has everything to do with Darren Ambrose. And the fact that there was no tea here when I showed up. Just lemon wedges and honey. No water. What?
I think that is a major issue that we're going to need to raise. I'm going to ask for a refund.
Yeah, I agree. That was not in the fine print or the big print. Yeah.
No, I mean, we were led to believe there'd be ample beverages, yes, hot beverages throughout the day,
yes,
and there clearly are not. In addition to the lack of podia, is that how you say plural of podiums? Podiums?
Would it be?
Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Podies?
Oh,
I don't know.
That's a good question.
There are things that need fixing, for sure.
So, Ibieri, incoming or 1 year away from being the CALA president?
I am 1 year away from being the CALA president. Actually, one heartbeat away, because Men Win.
That's a threat.
Men Win is coming up. And, you know, he does like marathons.
Yeah.
And I don't frankly think he's all that good at it. So I'm telling him, just stay healthy, drink plenty of water, take your vitamins, because I'm not yet ready to be president of CALA. I need you around for another year. But yes, 2024 is the year where I will be installed as president of the Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles.
Which is the largest plaintiff trial lawyer organization in the country. And by default, I think that means in the world, right?
In the world, and also the baddest.
Yep.
Yes, we get it done.
So what do you mean by that?
I mean, gosh, you think about the universe of trial lawyers. There are so many greats across the nation, really, and many of them are here. There are really good trial lawyers. But when you think about California and the concentration of talent, it is insane. I mean, hello, Mr. Ravipudi, right? We're sitting across from one another. You who come from a great firm, stellar reputation. But there are also so many other firms up and down the state that are just shattering glass ceilings and have achieved some insane verdicts. Just really, really solid professionals, trials lawyers. And they're all here in California. And so when you think about Los Angeles and our Trial Lawyers Association, you can walk into the room and see some of the greats. I mean, where can you go and find that? And so I think it's pretty awesome. We are the baddest. I mean, we just have some really good trial lawyers out here.
What, for folks like me who aren't from California and from the other parts of the country, and I'm from about the furthest part away from California that you can find, what do you think it is about California that's attracted so many great trial lawyers, or maybe breeds so many because of the culture here or the court system? What is it?
Oh, gosh, there's so many reasons. I think we have just a ton of talent. One is California. Who doesn't want to live in Los Angeles? It's sunny and it's great.
What about the traffic and the smog?
Oh, you can. I mean, it's the payoff, right? I'll sit in a car if I can get out my car and see the sun and not the rain and not the snow. I can deal with that. But I think it's a lot of things. There are a lot of reasons. We have some great institutions out here. The law schools are phenomenal. I think I went to one of the best, which is Loyola Law School.
I'm going to agree.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, there you have it, professor. Professor, if you didn't know, Mr. Ravipudi is a professor of law at Loyola. And it is a breeding ground, I think, for really gritty, hardcore attorneys. Some of the folks that are coming out of Loyola, I think, just have a passion about the law that you don't find other places. And maybe it's the training. I mean, there's a ton of hands-on trainings. There are seminars, webinars, practical programs. And I think people just, when they get out, they're ready to do the work. They come out with a skill set that most people don't have. We have Pepperdine, a lot of great people coming out of Pepperdine. Of course, UCLA, USC. And people tend to study here and stay here. And then for the folks that are transplants, they're coming out here because of the opportunities. Great firms. Our lawyers out here are getting great verdicts. I think the laws are more favorable to consumers. So who doesn't want to get in front of a jury when the law is really, designed to help people? And all those things combined, you know, you're going to have some great results. And I also think that there is another element that people overlook is that we tend to collaborate more in California. Of course, it's competitive. We all want to be great, the best, but we work really closely together. I think the idea that of like rising tide raises all boats is true here. People want to see other people succeed because if Rahul gets a great verdict, I mean, one, I get to put that in my mediation brief. People are knocking this out of the park. It increases the value of our cases. And then it also motivates me to work harder. I know that that is attainable. So people are constantly just working really hard. We're sharing information. We're collaborating. And so when one does well, we all do well.
So taking a step back, Ibby, how did you become a trial lawyer? And I know your whole background, but maybe some other folks don't. And I want to kind of dig a little deeper into where you started and how you got to where you are.
Gosh, I get asked that question and I don't know where to start. Really, I don't know where to start. How did I become a trial lawyer? One, I had to first become a lawyer. And a lot of that came from just my upbringing. My mother was incredibly influential when it came to just tracking where I was going to be professionally. She decided long before I did that I was going to be a lawyer. And told me, you are going to be a lawyer. And I didn't know what that meant.
Why do you think she wanted you to be a lawyer?
I think it was because parents lived their dreams to their children. I think part of my mother, just she wanted to be a professional. I think there was a lot of prestige that came with lawyering. But if I ask her, she would say it's because I love to read. I was very thoughtful and conscientious and she saw potential in me. I also grew up in a household full of people. I had a lot of brothers and I was in the middle and I was an instigator and a mediator. And so I had this ability to really just I think, interact with people in a way that, you know, my mom felt like she can go places. And then on my father's side, my father's from West Africa, and he comes from a tradition of storytellers. They're griots. They're the guardians of genealogy. So when there's not a written language, you have to pass on history orally. And there's a community of people who are tasked with preserving the history and passing along information generation after generation after generation. And essentially they show up in your home during a wedding, a baptism, anything of significance. And it is their job to tell the story of that family's lineage, their history, and they pass it on. They guard it for generations and generations. And I came from this tradition of storytellers. I grew up with that. My father was very much very proud of that. And so I didn't know what that would look like for me professionally, but when it came to actually going to law school and advocating, it felt very natural. I felt like I was telling people's stories. And my father is also very proud of that. Yeah, that's how I became a lawyer. And how I wound up in Los Angeles is because I was very much inspired by Johnny Cochran. He was the first lawyer that I felt like I could really relate to. And it was only after seeing him that I recognized that's what it means to be a lawyer. And it was during the OJ trial. And I was fascinated by him, absolutely fascinated.
Everything you must have been did. Quite young at that
I
time.
I was young, but I knew that.
How old do you think you
I
were?
I had just probably graduated or left middle school and entering high school, somewhere around that age. But, you know, Johnny Cochran was well known before the OJ trial. And he was very much a fixture in the Black community. But when he rose to prominence, I think nationally, during the OJ trial, when they're televising the trial and the drama of it and the characters. And to me, he was central. There was no, I mean, OJ, yeah.
Do you remember where you were when the verdict came down?
Yes, I do remember.
Did you watch it?
I did watch it. Who didn't watch the, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Yes. And everything that happened afterwards. And so for me, seeing Johnny Cochran was like, it was life-changing. I recognized then what was possible. I could see how people were drawn to him, how attracted they were to him, how much they were rooting for him, more so than his client. They wanted him to win. And he'd show up in the courtroom and he'd look good and he'd sound good. And he was so charismatic. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to do that. And that's how I wound up at Loyola. Got a brochure in the mail, and guess who was on the, you know, one of the pages, it says, who is Loyola? Johnny Cochran. I said, yes, that's where I'm going. Yeah. And so I found myself at Loyola, and I participated in the trial team, did a lot of trial competitions with some great lawyers, many of whom are still my friends and doing great things. And my goal was to work at the Cochran firm. That was my goal. And Johnny Cochran passed away in my first year of law school. And it was incredibly devastating for me, but I still
did you kept ever meet? Did you meet him?
I never met him. I never met him, but I followed his career very closely. I mean, I was trying to find ways to meet him. Trust me, but you know, I didn't give up on my dream to work at the Cochran firm, and I did. It was one of my first jobs out of law school, and for many years, my office was situated right next door to his, which. Obviously, he had passed, but the firm had kept his office intact. And there was something very magical for me just to go in every day and know that I was sharing a wall with someone that I looked up to. Even though he wasn't physically there, I could feel his presence. And so that's how I became a trial lawyer, so to speak. But when I became a real trial lawyer is when I started trying cases. You know, we all like to say we're trial lawyers. Many of us do. But I think I became a real trial lawyer when I started actually trying cases without fear of losing. It is hard to try cases. One, they're few and far between. It's not like trials just fall out the sky, right? It takes years of work to get to a point where you can actually argue a case in front of 12 people. And so when I first started my practice, there weren't a ton of opportunities to try cases. One, there weren't many trials. And then two, people aren't letting newer, younger attorneys try cases. When I did start trying cases, I recognized how much was at stake, right? Years of work and preparation. And it all comes down to a few days, sometimes weeks, but mostly days in a courtroom in front of strangers. And the fear that comes with that, the pressure that comes with, you know, what if I lose? So what I was seeing around me is people were more willing to settle cases than to try cases. The reality is like people just settle it. Do you really want to take that risk? And I was getting a lot of that, people talking me out of trying cases. And that there was a point where I recognized that, no, if this is what you want to do, if you want to tell people stories, if you want full justice for people, you cannot be afraid of trying cases. And that means you can't be afraid of losing. And so I don't have a fear of losing in the courtroom, which allows me to take enormous risks, right? I try cases that many people would say, what are you doing? But it's because I know that if we want full justice, you've got to lean into that. You have to lean into it and trust the 12 people that you're giving the case to, trust your skills, trust your abilities. Johnny Cochran used to say preparation, preparation, preparation. So you're always preparing and not be afraid of losing. And once that clicked for me, I was taking enormous risks, but I was seeing the rewards. I was winning more than I was losing. And, you know, and then I believe in my cases. So I think that that's really helped me in terms of trial lawyering, that lack of, not a lack of fear, but I don't let it influence me in the way that it probably influences other people. It doesn't dictate my actions or influence my decisions. If a case is worth trying, if I believe in it, I'm going to try it.
That's an amazing observation about getting over the fear of losing and being willing to put yourself out there and take those risks and try cases, because I think we all know that rationally, but to be able to implement it is a different thing, because it affects you on a, you know, subconscious level, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just, I'm going to make the decision to stop having fear and go in. I mean,
it's there.
It's there, but but there's no question that that's the central issue that we all have to struggle with in every case that we try, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you've done something that very few people are able to do, which is to overcome that and put yourself out there to try cases. Is there something that you attribute that to? Is it just your sort of core strength or background? Or do you think it's, do you have some insight to help other people that are trying to get where you are right now?
Well, I think where does that come from? I don't know where it comes from. I think probably the nurturing that I received growing up. My mother was very strong and instilled in me things that I think have really benefited me professionally and personally, namely confidence, right? And so that's been helpful. But in terms of just my practice, I recognize that as a young woman of color in the profession, you kind of have to be fearless. There are a lot of things that you need to overcome. And if you are afraid of this work, if you're afraid of the courtroom, if you're afraid of opposing counsel, if you're afraid of your colleagues, I mean, you're not going to get very far. You have to move past that. You really have to move past and believe that you can achieve, that you can accomplish, that you can prevail, that you can succeed, all of those things. And fear will really hold you back, more so than anyone else. The things that we are unwilling to do because of our own doubts and our own fears is far greater than any sort of intimidation that someone else can kind of throw at me. It comes from me primarily. I can easily move past people. My biggest hurdle often is myself. You know, it's like, what do you think about your abilities? What do you think about what it is that you can actually accomplish? And once I can get over whatever hangups I have, there aren't many hurdles I can't clear.
Can you give me an example of a case where you put this into practice, where you mm-hmm. said, okay, hey, A lot of people would tell me, I got to settle this case. Yeah. But you know what? I'm going to do what I do, and I'm going to trial on this one.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, there are so many. I think all of the past, all of the ones that I've had in the past couple of years, there's been some element of that. One, because my practice is structured a little differently than most. I do litigate cases, but very few. So, you know, most firms, you get a call from either someone who's been hurt, wronged, harmed, or injured saying, can you help? Or you get a call from another law firm that says, I have a case, you know, can you help? And so you take in the case and you do the work and then you try it, hopefully. My firm is structured a little differently. I don't necessarily take in cases. I try cases exclusively and almost exclusively for other firms. So
you're like a barrister in the English model.
I guess
except
so.
For the wig.
Except for the wig. And I mean, yeah, I guess that's partially true. I don't think of it that way. I think I want to do the things that I think I am best at, come natural to me, and focus my energy on those things. That seems to be trial advocacy, being in the courtroom. So I'm coming into cases now where I don't know anything about the case. I know nothing about the case. I've not met the client. Don't have the benefit of years of working up the case, and I'm totally unfamiliar with defense counsel. Don't know their personalities and really how to engage with them. So the last few trials, I get a call sometimes the day of, you know, hey, we've got a courtroom.
The day
Can
of
you
trial?
Be here at 1:30? Yes, yes, yes. Here's the judge. Wow. This is the department. See you there. Or my last trial, which Raul, I think we talked about, I found out I was in that trial when the jury consultant texted me and said, hey, we're out here in Bakersfield. I didn't realize you were in the case. I said, what case? He says, such and such just put your name on the record. What record? Are you in the courtroom? You're in the courtroom right now. Yes, I'm in the courtroom. It's like, oh, okay. And then that's when I realized, oh, I'm getting called into a case, which I did not know had already started. They were in the middle of jury selection. And so that's been my experience. And I think it will continue to be my experience. So when you ask about a specific case, I can talk about each one.
Can you just tell us how that works? I'm curious about that because... So who's putting you on that list that puts you into a case? Was that you were working with a different firm and said, if this case gets called into trial, I'll go try it for you?
No, it's more like people I know that I work with and are familiar with my advocacy skills. They know that there are certain things that I do well in the courtroom. Will have a case and say, you know, this would be a case that it would make sense to bring EBIDAN on. And that's really how it happens. So there might be some conversations in advance, like, hey, if anything comes up, just let me know if you need any help. And then some people actually take you up on that, literally.
And how do you get yourself ready to try the case if you don't know about it till the very last minute? Or do you know about it, you just didn't know it was going to be tried right then?
So just so we're clear, I don't come in and take over the case.
Oh.
No. I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of that. And I don't actually think that's very wise. Some people do, but for me, that's not how I handle it. I always try the case with a member of a team. So someone's already been working it up, someone who's usually very familiar with the case, in some cases not. Maybe they're getting up to speed on the case. But I have the benefit of being able to go to people and say, okay, explain to me in a nutshell what this case is about. And what I really, I think, bring to the table is that I don't have all of that history with the case where I start to get caught up in the weeds and I'm drinking the Kool-Aid and feeling like this case is perfect and we're gonna, you know, I don't have all that. I come in with a fresh set of eyes and my goal is to really simplify the case. And so I challenge the people that I work with to explain the case to me in a way that is incredibly simple. And if they can't do that, then I don't think the case is usually winnable. But the reason I do that is because it's my job to simplify the case in a way that a jury can take it and say, that makes sense. And they see it, they see the case in the way I think it should be seen, which is in it, at distilled to its very essence, the truth of it just kind of just permeating and them feeling like, okay, this makes sense. We're going to get this person justice. So when I come into the case, I start with what most people start with, which is jury selection, which is you don't need to know, in my opinion, much about a case to choose a jury, to select a jury. It's helpful to know the facts, to have focus grouped it and whatnot. Someone has probably done all that. But in terms of figuring out how best to connect with the jury and to figure out who are the best people to sit on that jury, you don't need to know every detail about the case. I don't need to have read every deposition. I just need to care enough about the case, care enough about the client, and know the story, the general story, well enough to say, that's the right person for this case. That's the person we want on this jury. And then I learn the rest as I go. I literally learn the rest of the trial as I go. Jury selection, I feel connected. Opening statements, let's talk about the story of the case. And the open statement is great because it's just a roadmap, right? It's just a roadmap. And then we get into the nitty gritty when we started talking about examining witnesses. That's when you really got to study the depositions. You have to understand things that require a bit more time. But by then, I'm familiar enough with the facts that I'm really focused on what is the heart of this case? What is it about? And I focus on just the essentials, because that's really all the jury cares about, the essentials. Tell us a story that makes sense, that we can follow, and then tell us what you want us to do. So that's my process in a nutshell.
Wow.
Could you do that, Ben?
I don't think so.
Ah, yes, you could. Let's do it.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
It sounds like a really incredible way to do this business, though, because the part of it that I think many of us find the most frustrating is the years of the litigation stuff leading up to the trial. And you get so worn down by that, that by the end of it, you're tired. You can be tired of the case. So it actually is kind of refreshing. I mean, I've had a couple experiences where I've been brought in at the end of a case, and sometimes it wasn't worked up the way you would like it to be, and there's things that were missing, but it's so refreshing to not have to, that's not your problem.
Yeah, you know? It's not my problem.
And you just go in and you just try the case that you're handed, and I do think that would be a nice way to do it.
Yeah. I do try to solve problems, though. I do try to solve those problems. That is the issue.
Fresh set of eyes on the same case that nobody else has looked at it from your perspective before.
Exactly. And sometimes I come in and think, all that stuff that you think is important is actually not. And why do I think that? Because as you're telling me about this case, it's not important to me. And I think if it's not important to me, it's not to be important to the jury. So tell me, I will do my best to tell you what I think is important. And let's focus on that. Let's try that. But yeah, it's crazy. It is crazy. And I'm trying cases that, the types of cases that I've never done before. I'm trying defamation cases. Everything that I've done for the last couple years has been, I've never tried that kind of case before. You know, let's see how that goes. Loss of consortium, employment. My training was primarily in civil rights and injury, but I'm doing all sorts of things now, because at the end of the day, I see myself as a trial lawyer, and I believe that any type of case can be tried and should be tried. So I challenge myself to do that regularly. I don't limit myself. I don't say that you are this type of trial lawyer, right? If you're a trial lawyer, you're going to try any case, period. And that's what I do. State, federal, criminal, civil. Let's go.
Do you feel like the themes kind of transfer from a defamation case to a loss of consortium case to a civil rights case to a personal injury case?
Yes. Every case has a story. A villain, right? A middle, or a beginning, middle, and end. A protagonist, right? It doesn't matter. It could be a real estate dispute. It can be a transactional, a breach of contract. There are always those elements. And if you can tell a story, it doesn't matter how complex the issues are in the case. Some people are very intimidated by traumatic brain injury cases and the experts, the neurologists, and all the, you know, the brain scans and how do you talk about it? Like, it that can be challenging, but if it's challenging to us, if we find it difficult to comprehend, how can we expect a jury to comprehend it, right? And so the theme is, can you tell a story that can captivate people, that they can relate to, right? It has to be relatable. They have to see themselves in the story somehow, either identify with the protagonist or see themselves as the person who's coming in to fix things, to like the savior, so to speak, you know? And then in terms of themes that I look for is that even the most complicated issue, subject matter can be simplified. And that's usually my challenge. It's like, how do I simplify it? How can I tell that story in a way that if I were talking to my 11-year-old son, who happens to be very bright, by the way, could he understand it? Could I explain to him what coup contra coup is? You know, when a traumatic brain injury, like when someone's hit in the head, how the brain moves, ricochets, why that matters. And him be able to tell me, oh, I get that. And ask follow-up questions like, oh, why? Well, what happens next? And then that's the theme of trial lawyering, is like, tell that story in a way that's simple and it's interesting. That's it. I mean, maybe it's a little bit more complicated than that, but well, I like to it
obviously
think it is
seems to work because you've had some incredible results.
Yeah.
And you're here presenting at the Trial Lawyer University on, what is it, on a case? You're doing a breakout room?
I did a breakout room yesterday, actually, on jury selection.
Oh.
And I did it with a colleague of mine and friend now. I guess we're friends. Sometimes I like him, sometimes I don't. His name is Kale Paris.
Nice.
Gosh. Anyway.
You made a face.
I did.
For the listeners.
He's listening, he knows what face I made. It's one of disgust.
And why did you do that?
Because, you know, we had a lot of fun. We tried a case late last year. It was a case we co-tried along with his father and some members of their firm. And we had a lot of fun, but it was a complicated case, a TBI case, and there was a loss of consortium element to it. And I came in and I took on one of the plaintiffs as a client, and we tried parallel cases. So his firm is trying one, representing one client and trying the case, and I'm representing another, trying another case. So you have two openings, two closings, two voir dires, two everything. And there were a lot of things that we had to do together. We had to collaborate. But, you know, there was also some tension. You know, we didn't always agree on how things should be done. And it's one of those cases where someone, you come in and they've been working on it for 4 years, and you come in on the day of trial and trying to tell people what to do, which I tend to do. So
So what did you teach in voir dire?
Well, connecting with the jury. So there are so many different approaches to jury selection. And Rahul and I have talked about this, and we actually did a panel about this not too long ago. But there's a science behind jury selection. You know, all the people who read the books, psychology and groupthink, and how do jurors relate to individuals, the importance of eye contact and voice and colors, the science behind it, like how your brain reacts to people and things. And then there's just the natural human element of jury selection, which is how do you connect in a natural, authentic way with just people, just conversing in its most basic human form? And how do you build relationships with people that you're meeting for the first time? And how do you inspire them and empower them and all those things? So we use the several hours in our bakeout group to really talk about those two different approaches and demonstrating what that looks like in a courtroom and asking every individual to get on their feet and actually try it. Choose a jury. Ask some tough questions. Be prepared for some not so nice answers. And let's talk about how you navigate, how you transition, how you can really inspire jurors to say things that they might not want to say, but you know they trust you enough to do it on that, because you need to know what they think to determine whether or not they need to be on the jury. So we had a really good group, and Kale and I had a lot of fun. And one of the great things about being here at the trial college with you all is that we do have the opportunity to have breakout groups and really work one-on-one with people. I don't know how many seminars you sit and you listen, and you can learn a lot by listening. But really, I think you learn the most by doing. You have to get on your feet and get those reps in.
Speaking of doing, do you want to give us a little snippet of your voir dire?
Oh, I mean, in what way? What do you want? I mean,
I don't
know. Oh my gosh.
Whatever you think is the high point.
There are, I mean, what are the high points of voir dire? I guess a high point of voir dire is when someone tells me.
We can be the jurors if you want.
You want to be a juror?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'd love to be a juror.
Oh, come on. Okay, come on. All right, juror number one, juror number two.
Am I one or two?
Obviously,
you look like a one.
Obviously,
hey,
one.
Yes. Yeah.
You look
on
like
a scale
a
of 1 to 10, I'm a one.
So, I mean, I'm just thinking about, if I were to ask you, juror number one, you're here in the courtroom and you've heard a lot about this case. You don't know all the facts, but just enough to determine whether or not you could be a good juror for this case. And I'm not interested in whether or not you can be good or bad for this case. I'm really just interested in getting to know you. Okay. So one of the issues that has come up in this case is whether or not you could award money for something that's not tangible, something like pain, something like suffering, the things that people find it difficult to put a dollar amount on. And I'm wondering, when you hear that we're here looking for justice, and justice means money in this civil system, for things that are not tangible, how you feel about that?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, are you able to put a dollar amount on something that we don't often assign a dollar amount to? Something like embarrassment, something like humiliation. Like if I were to ask you, can you put a dollar amount on humiliation that someone has suffered? Would you be able to do that?
Guy, I guess I've never been asked to do that, so I don't know if I could or couldn't, but I'm totally open-minded to doing it. But I guess it just causes me to think about the times in my life when I've been humiliated and embarrassed. And I guess I've really never thought about this, but if I was to flash back to one of those times in my life and somebody said, hey, I'm going to give you $1 million to embarrass you and to make you feel the way you're about to feel, I don't know if I would take that money. And I don't know what that means for my ability to answer your question.
So why wouldn't you be willing to take money in exchange for suffering, embarrassment, or being humiliated?
I guess what I'm saying is I felt like my humiliation was more than $1 million of humiliation. Somebody said $1 billion. Maybe I would have said, okay, I can stomach that humiliation. So I guess I'm saying I'm capable of doing it, but I don't know.
But you have living free of humiliation, living free of embarrassment. Is it fair to say that's something that's important to you?
Definitely.
And that you would not be willing to trade that in or give that up for any amount of money?
I think that's a fair statement.
So in this case, we're going to have to do something that's a little difficult. We're going to have to assign a dollar amount to humiliation, embarrassment, if we can show that that's actually what the plaintiff has suffered. And we will be able to give you kind of a guide, show you how you can make that calculation if necessary. If we're able to do that, if we're able to show you that this person has suffered humiliation and embarrassment, and we're able to kind of give you a formula or a means by which to calculate the value of that, is that something that you would be willing and able to do?
That is something I would be willing and able to do.
Thank you. And so what I'm doing here with Rahul is twofold. One, I want to know if he's a person who's going to be like, no, there's no way you can put a dollar amount on that. And don't ask me to do it because I won't. I don't believe in it. It doesn't make sense. I'm the wrong juror. And then the second thing I'm trying to get out of Rahul is I want him to start to put himself in the plaintiff's shoes and start thinking about the times in his life where he felt humiliation and he felt embarrassment and somehow relate. And then three, I want him to start talking about the significance, the importance of living a life that is free of humiliation and free of embarrassment in a way where other people are thinking, wow, yeah, you couldn't pay me enough. You couldn't pay me enough to put me through that. So that by the time I get to the point at the end of the case where I'm putting a dollar amount on it, they're thinking back to our earlier conversations about there is no amount too high. And I would never want to be in that position. And I trust her. She was interested enough to inquire. She cared enough. And she told me she was going to do her job. And she seemed to have done it. So yeah, let's go. What do you want? So that's how I kind of just talk about the things. And that's not an easy one, but most people don't ask for money for humiliation and embarrassment. But I feel like if you can, then you can certainly ask for money for the things that people are a little bit more willing to pay for, you know, but that's kind of how I approach those issues.
That was good. That was really interesting to listen to that.
Thank you.
At first, I thought the way he was going would have made him a juror you didn't want. But then as you talked to him more, it seemed like based on his life experience, clearly by the end, it seemed like a jury you would want right. on your jury, right? Would you have wanted Rahul on your jury after that interaction or not?
You know, I know him. So the answer is yes. But generally,
right.
No. If we're in role.
Putting that aside.
If we're in role, you'd be surprised what people say in jury selection about how they feel about money initially. Like they start off where Rahul started, which is, I guess I could try. I don't know who can really do that. And then you start really going a little bit deeper. And that's really what it's about. It's about going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and discovering what is it that you really feel about this? And without asking him explicitly, if this were you, what would you want someone to do? Or how would you feel? People will reveal things if you give them the time and space to do so and the permission. Like I genuinely want to know. No judgment, but I don't immediately strike people just because of the first thing they say. I'm looking for a little bit more. And I think when you pull back those layers, you'll find that most humans are kind and they want to do what's right. And it's easy to find the people who don't. Those people reveal themselves very quickly and very easily. You can almost sniff them out. Yeah. But you know, you figure out what people's belief systems are and why they have those beliefs. Part of jury selection is about just that human connection, learning about tapping into that human experience. No matter where we come from, no matter what our backgrounds are, our religion, our gender, our age, we have so many common experiences. People have experienced grief, pain, embarrassment, shame, love, right? Envy, jealousy. Many people have been bullied, harmed, neglected. And we just explore that. And we're thinking, how do we find, what are those things that are common amongst us? And when you have commonality, when you feel like you have something in common with someone, you feel close to them and you want to help them, right? You just do. So I want them to feel they have common things in common with me and they're connected with me. And I want them to feel like they have things in common or connected with my client. They feel that they're going to help them and me follow my lead mostly.
Well, I don't know how we're doing for time. So we could talk to you forever. You have such a nice style about you. Even when you're asking difficult questions, you're doing it in a way that really connects. And I think would probably cause people to really like you. One question I had about that is that you have such a nice style like that, that would it be harder for people to tell you things that you don't want to hear?
Oh, it's the opposite.
They feel comfortable with you and will tell you.
Listen, I don't know how to say this. That's how you know. It's like, I don't know. Yeah. And I don't, you know, don't take me the wrong way, or I don't mean to offend you. And that's when I know, yes, go. Please offend me. It's like, no, there's nothing you can say that can offend me. Trust me. And I challenge myself to get them to say the things that they're thinking, but they don't want to say. And that's when I feel like, okay, I'm making progress. We're getting some work done here. Yeah, absolutely. And I work on that. I'm constantly working on how to tease those things out. I tease them out slowly, but surely.
Mm-hmm. Ibby, you're awesome. Hey, Ben, can we agree that she needs to come back on our podcast another time? Oh,
only if you have hot water, tea bags, lemon and honey.
We do have that might exceed the budget for the show.
Yeah,
but,
I thought we had an endless budget, but you're like pushing the limits right now.
Come on.
If you're going to be in Las Vegas in October and Dan gets his act together with the tea.
Oh, yeah, I'll be there.
That could be an opportunity.
I'll be there. Unless I'm in trial. Is it on the weekend? Because sometimes he likes to do these things midweek. People have jobs.
It's on the weekend.
We have jobs. But yes, if it's on a Saturday or Sunday, I'm sure I'll be there. You may get me there on a Friday. We'll see.
Love it. Well, thanks so much, Ibby, for joining us.
Thank you.
You guys look really good. And I want to say this is a really nice setup. For those of you who are listening, it is clean. It reminds me of like a Steve Jobs presentation. You know, you have like the white backboard with this Elevate, that's LAW. And these two are seated on this beautiful couch. They're wearing lovely suits. Rose looks a little better than yours, though, just honestly. But that's okay. Used to. And then
I
see like these cup holders called Law Pods. Oh,
yeah.
It's all coming together.
Okay. But definitely state of the art. This is the real deal. With that said, I only work with the best. So if you're in Vegas in October and you have a setup like this with a bit of tea, you can count me in.
Thank you.
Love it.
Yes. Thanks, you guys. It was fun.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.